Everyone, and welcome to Cinema Joes, the podcast where three average Joes discuss the significant topics in movie culture. My name is Justin. I'm one of your hosts here, and I'm here today with my co-host, Alex. How you doing, Alex?
I would really like to get out of this car, Justin. I'd like to get out right now.
Oh, now keep going. What's the French word? Oh, I don't know any French. Damn it. So yes, like episodes past, a little bit of foreshadowing for our listeners. We are here, unfortunately, not with our co-host Noah. He is busy doing other things. He is quite the man in demand. But we do have, in his stead, we do have a special guest. And actually, this is part of our ongoing series that we've been doing recently, where we talk to guests in their either one of their favorite films or their favorite film and what it's meant to them. And then we kind of just talk about all the things that are great about it. And we have a returning guest with us. She joined us for our Oscar predictions podcast way back in the early part of this year, which feels like a century ago. We are pleased to have the co-host of And the Winner Still Is podcast. She's also the film editor for The Pop Break, Marissa. Hello, Marissa.
Hi there. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, well, we're very happy to have you back and very happy with the film that you chose, considering Alex and my feelings about it. So want to thank you for that. The film that I am alluding to is Before Sunset, the second film in the, well, as of now, trilogy, the Before trilogy from Richard Linklater, beginning with Before Sunrise, ending with Before Midnight. This is the second entry in that series. And this is a film that came out in 2004, I believe. And I believe even got some Oscar attention. So I wanted to, before we kind of dig into it, I kind of wanted to get your history with this film, like kind of how you discovered it in the first place, and as I said on other podcasts, just kind of what it's meant to you over the years.
So I first watched it, as I did with so many things, in 2004, or I guess it would have been five by the time I saw it, on like HBO. You know, they would just play certain things over and over and over again, and I was a, you know, movie fan back then. And I probably read something about it in like Entertainment Weekly or something somewhere, or maybe it was just on and the description sounded interesting to me. So I watched it once and then kept watching it. And I just think it's like such a perfect, like, I almost think of it as like a hangout movie, because it has such a relaxing sort of pace. I mean, it's just two people walking through Paris in the summer, in like a beautiful summer day, for 80 minutes. So it's not too much of a commitment. And I also was so obsessed with it that I made many people in high school watch it with me. So like back in the day, I would bring a couple DVDs to a place if we were going to hang out, because, you know, I'd be like, hey, you guys want to, they'd be like, you know, I have the DVD collection, so let me bring stuff. So I would bring that and like Best in Show and a couple other things. And we'd watch this quite often, actually. So I mean, most of my friends have seen it because of me sitting them down and putting it on a television. I love it. I hadn't seen Sunrise when I saw it, and I actually didn't see Sunrise until couple years, maybe two or three years later. I bought it in college and watched it, and oddly felt less connected to that than I do this, even though I would have been the proper age for Sunrise. And then, I mean, I still sort of feel the same way about it. And then, you know, when Midnight came out, I was being thrilled. I like raced to the theater to see it. I think I saw it at the IFC Center, and I was the youngest person there by like, and it was like an early morning, I think, because I don't know if I was employed when that second one hit, or maybe it was like a weekend and I was just so f-ing excited. But like, I'm pretty sure I was the youngest person there by like 50 years. It was nuts. I love the movie. It's just, if it's on TV ever, I absolutely will turn it on and watch it. I can pick up anywhere in it. Watching it again for this was like such a treat, honestly. I mean, I'm always happy to watch it, truly. I watched it yesterday before we recorded, and I just like, I don't know. It just makes me so happy to sit with these characters and in this relaxed pace while knowing that it is, even though it looks very relaxed, like none of it's improvised. I remember years ago I read the script for it and all of it is in there. Like every little line is in there. So it's just like a really well-written script by people who really know what they're doing.
Yeah, it's incredible that this is just entirely scripted, because I mean, like, on one level it's like, yeah, that's what acting is, but it feels so like naturalistic and just and it just feels like you're watching two people talk and just have this entire incredible experience, life-altering experience.
It's also like, especially watching it this time, you've seen it before, Alex. What about you, Justin? Had you seen it before?
Yes, this is the second time I've seen it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. But this time I was really struck by watching it again, how everything is building the whole time. Like, it acts like a normal conversation, but the way it builds is so well done throughout. Like, there are parts, we all know what happened, like, in the end, they sort of confess that they've been thinking about each other for years, right? But but they keep hinting at it, even from the beginning. Because one of the first things they say to each other is, like, when they're walking to that cafe, she says, like, it wasn't a slow fade. And he was like, yeah, it sure wasn't. And you can tell they're sort of testing to see how much the other person, like, remembers that day, and they keep doing it constantly, but they keep testing each other to see how hurt they're gonna get if they admit what they eventually do, which is like, I've thought of you every single day since, and I think our whole lives would be different if we'd met up again, basically.
Yeah, and they even have to lie early on in their encounter, because you know, they don't want to go too far, overstep their bounds.
The thing that always gets me is that you don't realize that he is married until like the 40-minute mark, I think, is when she finally asks, like, by the way, I read in that article that you're married and you have a kid. And that whole time they've been flirting. And she asked that literally just after they've basically been talking about, you know, possibly having sex, which is like mental and like psychological gymnastics of those couple minutes is like insane to me, and the way they play it off is insane. It's just incredible.
Yeah, well, I just, and it's just such a, it's such a great build to that moment too, because like it becomes increasingly conspicuous the way that she repeatedly invokes former relationships and current relationships in their conversations, and he absolutely refuses to engage back. Like, he'll engage with her like experiences, but he never offers his own when it comes to a relationship. And like, when you go back and like, when you know that she knew that he was married, like, it becomes so transparent that she's trying to get him to talk about his wife also, so that way it could be safe for them to have this conversation. And he just won't give that to her because he wants to indulge in the fantasy of still being with her. And if he brings up his wife, that's going to ruin everything. Right, it's just, it's so great.
It's just like, I don't know. It's just like a delicate balance of flirtation and chemistry and, I don't know, brilliant writing that doesn't seem like it's brilliant writing. I mean, like, there are moments, I suppose, where they're like, I sort of feel the line, but like, that's only because I've probably seen it 150 times or something. <you
know>? Yeah, I should say, like, I'm just going to come out right and at the very start say this is one of my all-time favorite movies as well. I'm a huge Richard Linklater fan, and I definitely kind of fell in love with him as a auteur around these movies. Like, I discovered him in college, basically. I think weirdly enough, I had seen School of Rock, of course, but that not like, I didn't know that was a Richard Linklater film when I saw it, you know. And then I think that the first movie that I saw of his where it was like, oh, this is a Richard Linklater movie was the Me and Orson Welles movie with Zac Efron.
Oh, okay.
Which is, like, honestly, I still think that it's a very charming movie. It's but fine. Definitely not, like, his... It's not his best movie. I'll say that. And definitely different from his, like, what he's most known for, you know, which is his very, like, realism and conversational style and stuff. And yeah, after I saw that and I enjoyed it, I was like, let me dig into more about who this guy is. And then I found his filmography. And this, like, the Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, were just, like, sitting on Netflix. And I was just like, I'm going to watch these and see what they're all about. And I just, like, immediately fell in love with them. Because I am just, anybody who's listened to this show long enough probably knows that I am a sucker for movies where people, like, sit in rooms and talk to each other. Like, if that's the only thing that happens, I'm just like, yes, give me more. Like, that's so much more exciting than, like, the best action sequence for me. So like, knowing that that's his style and, like, getting to see how these two films, Before Sunrise and Before Sunset, kind of speak to each other, like, I definitely just immediately was engaged with what he was offering. And then I watched them again a couple years later, leading up to the Before Midnight release, and mostly just so I could kind of talk my one friend into seeing Before Midnight with me. I basically, like, showed up to her house and was like, we're watching these two movies and then we're going to the theaters and watching the next one. and yeah, that's, like, Before Midnight is a movie that I saw 4 times in theaters. I'm just, like, a huge, huge diehard fan for this whole franchise. But Before Sunset is just an extra special film for me. I think that it is just, it's just so electric, and so just the way that they do this delicate dance, like you're talking about, Marissa, is just so, I mean, we're going to talk about it for this entire review, and I'm afraid I'm going to sound like a broken record where I'm just going to be like, yeah, it's great, it's so good, and this part was good and this part was good. It's going to be like the Chris Farley show. But it just is, it's just so special. Justin, what is your familiarity with this franchise?
Well, so I might be, of the three of us, I probably have seen this the least amount of times, because I've only seen it twice. But I think I loved this time even more than the first time, honestly. I mean, and I loved it when I saw it the first time. It's my favorite Linklater film, and I can actually say, like, I have seen all of Linklater's films, so that means a lot, because I love so many of them, and this is kind of the top for me. And it was, you know, without getting too into the weeds of my personal life, it was very interesting watching this the first time being with someone versus now being single, and much closer to the ages of the characters. So that was definitely, you know, I think that definitely added something, and maybe that's, you know, I don't know if I can credit the film with that, but, like, it really did mean a lot more to me this time. And I remember when I did watch these films in order, so I had seen Before Sunrise before I saw this. And the thing that I remember really liking about Sunrise was, I was sort of under the impression that it was just going to be totally idealistic, you know, just charming people, you know, having fun together and just falling in love and all that great stuff. So I was, like, trying to like it, but maybe not love it. And I actually did end up loving it. And I actually think one of the reasons is because you could sort of see the fissures that might develop later on in the series. Like, that was something that I really didn't expect, and I really gave the film a lot of credit for. And maybe I should have even expected, just because I had seen other Linklater films, to know that that's, you know, he's not someone who would want to leave out any of that, you know, that reality of being with somebody, whether it's early in a relationship or later in a relationship. But this film, just, I remember when I saw it the first time, I just remember it being like, I just remember kind of being in the state of suspense the whole time, just wondering, like, where is this going? Like, what are their intentions toward one another? What's happened in their lives? Like, what possible, you know, like, what possible, you know, sort of, like, what losses could happen as a result of this seemingly burgeoning relationship? Like, there was almost, like, this sense of, like, hurtling towards something that could be wonderful or could be terrible or probably somewhere in between. And the way this film is able to keep you there in, you know, with fairly minimal camera work, like it's all pretty fluid. It's very much, it's a lot of medium shots of our two characters pretty much from like the waist up, and the way it just kind of like patiently follows them. And yet I actually feel like that adds a lot to this. It really does create this sort of unassuming quality that belies a lot of the tensions at the root of who these people are now and who these people feel like they want to be. And I feel like it's the kind of film where everything's working together, even if it's not, you know, sort of, even if it's not necessarily overt, even if it's not like ostentatious, it's just so expertly put together and acted. And I just, and you know, you can see it, I think, in some of the, in the, in Before Midnight as well, where you do see that Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy are credited on the screenplay. The impression I get, even though it is scripted, is I almost think of it as like a Mike Lee sort of thing, where you get the sense that they really did take the time to sort of develop the script and probably did improvising, but then like actually use that to create the script. So that's kind of the impression I got watching it, but it does create a much more natural feel as a result. So
yeah, they're credited on this one too. Yeah. The only one they're not credited on is that first one.
That first one, right? That's
Yeah, and I believe that they kind of did do a lot of the writing on that first one also with Richard, and it was just kind of like a, like it was just like a thing of the fact that they were like young and like actors and stuff that they didn't really get the credit that they deserved the first time around, but they definitely got it the last two ones, and it's and I think what like based on. Since this is one of my favorite films in one of in my favorite franchise of films, I have like over the years read a lot about it. And Justin, I do believe you're correct that this is the sort of thing where when they want to make one of these, they basically just like go to the city for a couple of weeks and they workshop with Linklater like all of the different experiences that they want to bring into the film and all the different ways that it could go. And they rehearse a lot and they find all of the locations that they want to do, and then they like shoot it pretty quickly. That's how they made Sunset, and that's how they made Midnight as well. So I think, and I think that that process and how special and different that process is really pays off in terms of how well developed the characters feel on screen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you can tell the thing I always think about with like the two of them on screen is the chemistry that they like effortlessly project in this one. And a lot of it is like, it's probably just like, you know, Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke are friends and they probably keep in touch. So they can sell this instant reconnection that the characters have because they have it in real life. And they work so hard to create that on the page and like, you know, basically do a boot camp beforehand, like the nicest boot camp you could have beforehand of like be living in these characters' minds and wondering what they've been doing for the last couple years. And like there, some of the, my favorite moments from the movie are like, I love the script obviously, but the things that I think sell it for me, the things that always like brutalize me when I watch it are the physical moments. Like there's and the like intimacy that it sort of suggest between them. There's that moment when they're walking into that park for the first time up the stairs and a leaves are falling and one gets in her hair and he just instantly reaches up and takes it out because he is A, so obsessed with her and B, desperate to touch her. And then like in the car later, the car you wanted to get out of, Alex. when she starts freaking out, he almost reaches out and touches her, but then he doesn't. And then when she, and they're both looking away when it, she's not looking at it when it happens. And then the same thing almost happens when he starts to tell her the fact about his dreams about her. That moment where she like reaches almost to like touch his hair and then it's like, oh, no, never mind. And then he's not looking at her, but you want him, you want them to touch each other, but they just like, they can't get past that yet. They're just, it's, they're not there yet. And like, those are the things that it's like really elevate the whole thing for me. It's just this, this physical intimacy that they project and that like plays throughout both the first and the third as well. Like, you know, and it evolves each time, you know, the first they're getting to know each other, the second they're reacclimating to each other. And then in the third, it's like, they've been, you know, married for, or they've been together for years. And it's like, they had an, everything is so complex, even the touching,
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, and that's and that is a dynamic to the film that I really love, and something that I was a little bit surprised about watching this time, because in my head, I always remember the movie as this kind of like slow progression to this like great crescendo where it all kind of comes out. But really, that's not what it is. It's really this kind of like circular kind of spiral that they do, where they keep like kind of edging, like touching the flame and then like reaching, like almost touching the flame and then reaching back, and almost touching the flame and then reaching back. And every time that they do almost touch the flame, they go a little bit deeper and they go a little bit deeper, but then they pull away and then they pull away. And it's just so carefully orchestrated, as we're talking about, but it feels so honest about the way that human interaction works, right? Like they're desperate to find that, to reestablish the tremendous intimacy that they had the first time around, but it's so scary to do that and so dangerous, right? Because they have so much to lose, and they also just like they don't want to ruin that moment that they had together by like bringing it back, but they also can't help but do it because there's just such a strong pull. Right. And watching them kind of like, it's just it's such a tease to the audience in a way where you're just like, come on, just do it, come on, like, you know, like, but it's just so true to the way that people actually interact, and it's just so well observed, and it makes that payoff so much more powerful, I think, when you finally get it.
Yeah, I mean, that shit in the car is like top scenes of my, like top five scenes of my life. I love it so much. Like if I only, like when I would watch it on TV, I'd be like, you know, if I only have time for one scene, that's the scene I'm going to watch. You know, I'll flip back to whatever and then be like, is it time for, yeah, it's time for that. Let me go back to the scene.
Well, and that's like, that's the scene that should ruin the movie, honestly. It should break the movie because it's this extended period of time where they each get this long monologue about how miserable they've been basically for the last 9 years. And it's so much more theatrical that in theory, at least, than like anything else that we've seen before and anything else that comes afterwards, really. But it's so grounded emotionally that they feel so connected and you feel so connected to their experiences that it just hits so hard, and it just makes the movie so much greater than it could have been otherwise.
Yeah. And the movie's earned it by then, because you've been waiting for them to say these things almost. Like they've hinted at them and they've hinted at how much they want to say it, but they've finally gotten to this point of intimacy, A, and the B, they both know that technically they're on the way to drop her off and he's going to be on his way to the airport. So like, this is a thing of like, not only have we gotten to this point where we can finally feel, you know, move to say these things to each other, but we have to, or we may never get the chance. It may just go unsaid. And like, that's, I think part, like, I want to touch on something you said of like the theatrical part of it, which is like, I was thinking this time around, like, I wonder if, like, is this film cinematic, essentially? Like, would it be different if you shot it on a stage? And I think the answer is yes, because like, I really do think there's something to these long takes and this like slowly roving camera through a city of like, I think it helps build the tension in this incredible way that you wouldn't necessarily feel if you were sitting in an audience watching two people on a stage have the same conversation, maybe just set in like two or three rooms. You know, maybe they move from a cafe to a, or the bookstore, the cafe to maybe, you know, we're told they're on a boat or something. Do you know what I mean? Like if there were scene cuts, I mean, I think part of the reason you get so invested is that like the film is drawing you along, not letting you leave this conversation because it's basically told in real time. There's like very, very, very few moments that are elided.
And he's able to do
that. Yeah, I think that's like, very well observed.
Yeah. And there's like a couple of things that, like, just to speak to what you were just talking about, Marissa, like, you really do get to see a good amount of the city, even though you're focusing more on the two of them, I think, than anything else. Like, you are navigating these I mean, even, like, the boat tour, which supposedly is more of a tourist thing, which, when they, for some reason, I just, like, I couldn't remember how that boat trip went, so I was, like, for some reason, was just, like, sort of, like, you know, stealing myself for like a just a really cringeworthy experience. Luckily, it's nothing like that. But you really do get a sense of like this huge world that's out there as these people are kind of in their own little world passing through it. And that is, I do see that as being very difficult to try to manufacture on the stage. And even just like little touches, I think Linklater is not like, he is just like the opposite of a showy filmmaker, and I feel like over the years that's something that I just really love about him. But even just like, I think because of that, you start to notice like the times where something jarring does happening, like it does happen, like the one moment when the bench scene, for example, where all of a sudden this camera that's been patiently following them because of because of this spontaneous move from Jesse to reenact this scenario that the two of them have concocted, you know, almost like has to catch up with him as he's sprinting to the bench with her in tow. Yeah. So you've got little things like that. At another moment,
that moment is like such a sweeping, in any other film that would be this sweeping romantic whip pan that ends in them embracing, but instead it ends in being like her being like, ah, no, like freaking out.
Yeah, and then the camera has to kind of like readjust again, like it's like, oh, okay, now we're caught up.
Yeah, it's like a violation a little bit of the rhythm that you've established with the cinematography, and in just the same way that it is for Celine as well.
Yeah, and the intimacy between them that's always been on, like, you know, it hasn't quite been fulfilled. Like, it's on this razor's edge, and, like, that appears to be a moment where, uh-oh, like, we're going to cross that line now.
Yeah, and that's when she brings up the wife, which is great, because mm-hmm. that's clearly been on her mind this entire time. And
yeah. What better time?
Noticeably absent from his... although not really, because again, it's like he's actively withholding that information. So it's clearly is on her and on his mind in a way that like it makes it's like subtly more complicated than I think that maybe a first view would let you realize the way that they handle that.
That moment is truly right after she's just pretended that she does not remember that they had sex the first time they met each other. And she, you know, she later says, she's like, I don't know, sometimes you just lie about shit. And it's just this, like, there's those, usually those would be the, like, climaxes of a play, but that's, like, in the middle of the movie, that whole sequence, you know, that those three big moments. And it's just in the middle of the fucking movie. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have to say, I was very much like, okay, I've seen this movie a couple of times now, and I obviously love it. So on this watch, I'm really going to try to stay focused on the way that Linklater, like, shoots the movie, because people talk about it all the time, and I'm always so wrapped up in the emotion and in the connection between these two that I always lose track of that aspect of the movie. So I'm like, I'm going to really focus on it this time. And then, like, within 10 minutes, I was completely just, like, I was so engaged and engrossed in the film. I just completely lost track of the cinematography again, all over again. It's just, like, it's so, because it's just so hard for me, at least, to just not get sucked in. But I do think that what you were saying, Marissa, is true, that, like, it's undoubtedly an aspect of how skilled he is as a director that gives that feeling to me. Like, it's all working in concert in a way that, like, really helps build that momentum in a way that you just couldn't get if it was just two people statically sitting in one place on its stage. Even if the dialogue is strong enough that it would still be satisfying to some degree, you really would lose a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think Justin, you were the one who said it's like, it's engrossing. Like, it just, it sucks you in. The film just sucks you in, and then you're just, I don't know, it's hard, it's almost, it's so subtle in its, what it's doing with its filmmaking, and, like, on every level that, like, you don't even realize how well it's working or what a feat it is that it is this good, realistically.
Yeah, it's true, and I think that, like, another aspect of that is this ticking clock. Like, he has like 30 minutes before he has to get on this plane, like, to leave for the airport. And it's like, that just creates so many, like, it creates so many more interesting aspects to the way this story develops than you would expect. Like, if you just tell somebody, like, oh, there's a ticking clock, so, like, they're going to run out of time, you think, oh, there's, like, so much tension to, like, make sure that, like, you get to everything that you want to say to this person. But it's more complicated than that, because there's so little time. There's also a lot of tension in terms of not wanting to say too much, not wanting to get too deep, because he's leaving. You know, so it's like, why risk being that vulnerable with a person who's literally on their way out of the country, you know? Yeah. So it adds this whole other element, and it works in tandem in a way that's really, really complicated and really powerful, and really just creates so much stakes in what is just an hour long conversation, basically, you know? Yeah. It's really incredible.
It's like, well, they literally have to fit in everything they wanted to say to each other for 9 years and 80 minutes. It's like,
yeah,
it's not like the pressure is so high, but they're clearly aware of it. But the film doesn't feel like it's aware of it because it's so deliberate in what it's doing that it doesn't let you think about it until you absolutely have to think about it. You know, it's like when he's upstairs in her apartment, you're like, oh my God. It's like, I remember when I used to show this to friends, I was in Catholic high school, with some, you know, and all of the sort of uptight views of the world that would have meant in a lot of my friends, and especially one of them. And she was just like, I remember at the end, she was just like, I mean, do you think they get together? And I was like, I mean, I kind of think they do. And she was like, but they can't. He's married. And she was just like, she was just so scandalized by this, like, the idea that, like, he is, you know, not going to get on that plane. And but that's the thing about, like, before midnight, it's like, it was such a, it is this thing of, like, am I a cynic? It recreated the thing of the first of, like, am I a cynic or am I a romantic? What do I think happens after this? And like, it's so, like, the way it fades out is cruel, but it's also so potent and smart to leave it on that note of just like all of this insane potential. And like, you know, realistically, it could have gone a lot of ways. You know, maybe he did, maybe he could have left, maybe he could have stayed, and then they break up 2 years later or something like that. Like, so many things could have happened. And like, I think it's a feat of the franchise that everyone has, like, each one. None of them are disappointing to me, realistically.
Yeah.
Like,
it's true.
Before Midnight is such an experience. And like, I remember showing it on like DVD to someone who I'd shown it to in high school. I'd shown Before Sunset to her in high school. And then she had been like overseas, like working with the Red Cross. So she didn't see Before Midnight in theaters. So I showed it to her on DVD in my apartment like years later. And she at the end of it, she was like, sobbing. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty tough. This is the second time I've seen it. And she goes, how can you bear it? Like, how can you bear to see this more than once? It's so brutal. Like, I don't know. It's just, it's incredible. Like, everything that these films set up and do. And like, I like all of them, but this one does feel so potent in a way that the other two, I mean, also do, but in a way that feels different because it is supposed to be this one very specific amount of time that we're watching unfold in real time, you know?
One thing I was thinking about, especially when I saw it the first time, compared to something like Before Sunrise, which I think has this kind of magical glow to it, and part of that is because it takes place mostly at night as opposed to this one, which is kind of late afternoon, evening. But just like the look of Paris here, I haven't seen enough Parisian set movies, but it just struck me as like a very earthy kind of tone, like a lot of browns.
Yeah.
And that just, like, considering where these people are in their lives, like, to me, that just was like really purposeful. I mean, these are people who feel like they don't necessarily have their lives ahead of them, who don't feel like they have that promise that maybe they did at the time of the other movie, or feel like perhaps that, you know, this is, you know, they're a little more cynical about the world. So it just makes sense from the perspective of the, you know, sort of outlooks of these two characters at this time, to go with that kind of color palette. But I just think it also just kind of, it makes it feel more grounded. Like, it just, you know, almost like literally seeing it as this earthy color. I just thought was really, you know, to me, that struck me as, again, not something that, like, jumps out at you, but is, like, it's kind of hard to escape, you know, because that's kind of what they're walking through.
Yeah. No, I think you're totally right. I mean, I think that warm, golden sunshine that they're constantly lit with throughout this is so, you know, reflects or is part of, like, conveying the warmth between them, realistically. Like, it just feels so settled and, like settled in a way of like, they're adults now, so they're a little less terrified of the future, maybe, or maybe not. It's not, the potential is maybe not as important to them. Like, you know what I mean? Like, kind of what you're saying. Like, yeah. they're adults now. They see things differently, and they both do say it, you know, different points. Like, I'm not sure I can believe in romantic love anymore, which is insane because they're literally having the most romantic experience any two people could ever have, you know? So it's like, but they've clearly been so hurt by the lost potential of that initial meeting that, like, it's just changed so much. And, like, yeah, I know, I do. I think the coloring is absolutely, like, the time of year is, mm-hmm. is integral to what makes the, what we're seeing so potent. I mean, truly, if they were walking through a snowy Paris at night, you know, I don't know if it would have this. I don't think, no, it wouldn't have the same effect at all, you know?
Yeah. Well, and I totally agree. Like, it's, of course, like, the first one was before sunrise, so this is before sunset, and that's very cute, but it really has, like, a major impact on the film, because, like, the way that I saw the, like, that the sunshine coming down on them like that throughout the film is this kind of, like, it is, like, sunset is gorgeous, right? It's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Sunset in Paris is as beautiful as you can get, right? It's this picturesque kind of almost like poetry come to life. But it's
the best time to film. Everybody says it.
It's the golden hour, right? Like, that's the whole thing. But it's incredibly tenuous and incredibly fleeting, right? It's mm-hmm. so and that's what their connection is right now. In this moment, like, they have this thing that is incredibly beautiful, and it is, every second that they indulge it, it is slipping away from them further and further. And, like, that's a great metaphor for their lives at this point too. And, like, as someone who is very close in age to them at this point, I think that really hits home too, this idea that, like, their life is settling into what it will be for the rest of their life, right? At least that's the anxiety that both of them feel. And so they are running out of time to change things before it settles for good. And that's just so potent to build this whole dynamic off of. And it just, like, every piece of this movie is, like, oozing with that, like, sense of desperation of, like, fighting against time before it's too late, before you're stuck in this life that you don't want anymore.
That's a great point. I mean, it does feel like their last, they do project this feeling that, like, this is their last chance to maybe be happy for the rest of their lives, if they can act on this or figure it out or something, you know? I will say it was sort of shocking. Like, this is the first time I watched it I watched it like 2 years ago when the Criterion Blu-ray came out. But there's that moment early on when she's talking there at the cafe, and she's talking about, like, I had this nightmare that I was, like, 23, and then I woke up, when I was 32, I had a nightmare that I was 23, and when I woke up, I was 32, and then I woke up again, it was, like, I was 23, but then I woke up in real life, and I'm actually 32, and I'm currently 32, and I was, like, okay, I didn't come here to be attacked today, like, how dare you, and that's the first time I've ever been the exact age of one of them in, while watching it, you know, like, because I saw Before Sunrise too late, I think, or maybe I was a little too early. I might have been, like, 19 or something when I saw it. And then this I would have seen even earlier. So, like, it was very shocking when she said that. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm just going to jump out my window now. This is horrible.
Yeah, when I saw this for the first time, like, I was in my early 20s, and they felt so far away from me in terms of, like, I could connect with their experiences, because I think I've always just, like, secretly been able to most connect with, like, people in the middle of their life having, like, an existential breakdown, like, since I was a small child. But they still felt like people who were, like, they're adults, right? Like, I'm still, like, in college. I'm still, like, I just graduated college, whatever. Like, this is so distant. And now when I watched it, they really felt like peers in a way that was very upsetting, because I could really just relate to it on an even deeper level. And everyone said that would happen, and I was always like, come on, I appreciate it for what it is now. I don't need to wait until I'm 30. And they were right. I was wrong.
Yeah, I was shocked. It was quite something, because I was like, well, thank God this is early in the film and there's a lot more to come, because I really can't dwell on this right now. I don't have the things are too, not during quarantine. I can't do this. Like, I'm going to leave that for later and probably, like, stay up on, you know, a random night in 6 months and be like, 32? Selena's 32? How dare they? Do you know? It's like, I can't.
Well, we talked on a different episode about It's a Wonderful Life. And at one point in that movie, they George Bailey is revealed to be 28 years old, and I nearly had a heart attack.
That's pretty interesting too, because he is actually older than that in the. I mean, like, Jimmy Stewart is older than that. I mean, not that we need to talk about it, but
I think he was in, like, his late 30s when he did that.
Yeah, he's in his late 30s.
Yeah.
I looked it up. He was 35 when he made that movie. And I think, like, by the end, like, the main action of the film takes place when he's, like, around 32, 33. So, like, he was pretty close to his actual age. Mm. It just is, you know, 1946, your mid-30s were a very different time than in 2004 when Jesse and Celine were going through it.
Wow. It would have been even more insane if they had cast Jean Arthur in It's a Wonderful Life, because she would have been in her mid-40s by then. Unbeknownst to the world. Wow. People didn't know her real age until she was dead.
Wow. If only I could be that lucky. Just
kidding. We all should have started lying about our ages years ago. I should have never admitted I was 32 like Celine.
Yeah, well, you know, according to my nieces and nephew, my mom is still 21. So, you know, somebody's been doing it right.
So I just wanted to ask what you guys think about the fact that these are two people who, you know, as much as this film is about the two of them wanting to be with one another, you know, that's, I think also we get so much of their personal lives, both their disappointments and some of their accomplishments. And I couldn't help but thinking as I was watching this that, like, so much of what they want out of their lives and, like, outside of their romantic life and their romantic life is kind of tied together in ways that they're sort of wrestling with. And I guess I wanted to ask what the two of you think about that. Think about the ways in which everything else in their life is impacting what they want out of their romantic life and vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, like, it feels like the film is sort of catching us up on, like, what did these people these little idealist romantics that we met 9 years ago, what did they end up doing with their lives? How did they channel it? And, like, him writing that novel makes sense, both for the reasons he admits and, like, with who he was then. And her being an activist and, like, you know, actively working to better the world makes sense for her too. But it is interesting the way that, like, this time I was really struck by the way that she sort of, I don't know, the way that she sort of intimates almost that, like, the romantic disappointment of not being able to meet Jesse again 9 years earlier, and, like, coupled with her grandma's death and all these things happening at once, and that maybe, and this idea that maybe romance as a concept died for her, pushed her from, I think, being a little less romantic than she was in the first one, and, like, really channeling things into, like, concrete ways to better the world. Like, it's all sort of implied, and she never really, like, makes that connection, but, like, I don't know, for me, that it felt like that could have been in there. And then, I don't know, especially this time watching it, like, with the benefit of having seen Before Midnight, like, I think all of that stuff plays out really interestingly in the next one as well, like, where his writing and what the writing means to other people, and then the way that puts pressure on them, like, influences, like, his work and her life and the way she thinks of his life. Like, that scene when somebody asks, in Before Midnight, when, like, somebody asks him to sign the book about them, and she's like, oh, you're the wife, can you sign it too? And she's like, I'm not going to do it. And because she just doesn't want to take credit for this art thing, this piece of art that she didn't make, and that also she has really complex feelings about, because it's like she's pressured to be in this love story by it. Like, I think I always say the thing that they struggle with in Before Midnight is that they're being crushed by the weight of their own love story. And, like, you know, it's a big part of it. And, like, there are seeds of that here, of, like, her being like, I think, you know, part of it is self-defense and maybe, you know, her own neurotic sensibilities, which she tries to underplay, of, like, not being, having to see herself through someone's eyes and maybe not living up to the ideal that he sees in her, or, like, not, like, in the next film, it almost feels like maybe she would have liked to do something artistic, but she never did or hasn't up until that point. You know, because she clearly is an artist too. She sings, she writes her songs. Definitely, I think he says it later in Before Midnight, like he influences or she influences his writing in terms of just like actual writing, you know? So I don't know. I mean, it all interplays so interestingly, but like for me, the job stuff almost doesn't pay off until the third one in a weird way. Like it's set up here and not a bad way. It's just like set up here because it's not something they don't care about it at this point. But in the third one, it's very important because it's like now they have to decide what's important for our lives and our jobs and our kids, basically. So, but yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's really well observed. And I think that an interesting aspect of the Jesse side of that equation is, like, as you said, it seems like for Celine, she channeled all of her romantic ideals into her work because that was a safe place to put it in a concrete way because of everything that you said. I think with Jesse, like, his big takeaway was sort of, like, just it was impossible for him to make sense of the fact that he could love this person so much and she could love him and then she was just not there. And so he ends up literally writing a book in order to get inside of her head and figure out what happened and what went wrong. Right. And it's like, in the meantime, while he's doing that, he's just kind of following through with these like rote expectations that he had, that everyone else has for him. So he's like in his private time or professional life, like workshopping, like how did this all go wrong? And in the meantime, he's creating a bigger mess for himself in a way that I think is really interesting.
Yeah, he has that line on the boat about getting married where he's like, at one point I just decided like maybe it didn't matter who it was as long as I was committed. And then it clearly did not backfired on him.
Right. Well, and why? Because Celine didn't commit to him, right? Because like he committed to that promise and at least from his perspective, she didn't commit back. And so now he's kind of fetishizing the idea that commitment is the most important thing, more important than love, because he had love and it didn't mean anything because he was still brokenhearted. And that's just like such a relatable, like human kind of like emotional response to something traumatic where it's just like, no, don't do that. But like, you totally see how it tracks.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's important to think about the way their reactions and like what they've done since are heavily influenced by why they didn't or why they did and then were devastated at not showing up or, you know, when they were supposed to meet again 6 months after their first meeting in Vienna, you know?
Yeah. Well, and so another thing that I really like about what happens throughout this film is, and I like it because this is something that me and my friends do all the time, is this kind of like compulsive need to find like narratives around your life that justify everything and make it make sense.
Yeah.
And they cycle through between the two of them, they cycle through like a half dozen different narratives about and rationalizations about like what their life has been and why it has been that way. And like none of it is really true. Like the audience can see it all from like this third person perspective, and you actually can kind of compile it, like fill in the blanks and like connect the lines like we're doing and saying like, well, this is how these people's lives progressed and why, but they are constantly trying to figure out a way to contextualize what's happened to them and why they are the way they are. And they're constantly not hitting the mark really in their actual accounting. And it shifts over time, the more and more willing they are to be vulnerable with each other as they try to create these narratives for themselves. And that's also really interesting too.
Yeah. It's like, well, because yeah, there's so much self-protection involved in why they are describing what they do and why they've made certain choices. You know, her whole thing about like, I choose men, or he asked her at one point, are you dating that photojournalist? Because it's like, he's not around as much and you don't have to like, you know, constantly be thinking about the romance. And she's like, yeah, absolutely, but also I can miss him when he's gone. Like, I'm so confused about it. Like, it's constant, you know. They're both, but and I'm sure both of those things are true, but like who knows if she's actually analyzed why that's true, like why she's self-protecting and why she refuses to like, you know, everybody gets married after they meet her, and they say you're the one who taught me how to love. But it's like she's got to be making choices to leave herself in that position on some level, realistically.
Yeah, and is that even true, or is she just talking about Jesse? Because there's other points where she says, like, this is this constant, like, she says something about, like, all the men are assholes to her, and then she, like, immediately admits, like, that's not true at all, that's just how I feel, because this is, my experiences are so empty, and I just don't have the words to really express it, and I totally, again, like, I totally relate to that feeling of just, like, you want to just, like, reach for broad generalizations just to communicate a feeling, even if there's not actually, like, inherent truth in the specific example, because it's just so hard to articulate these, like, really complicated, like, existential feelings about, like, your life and, like, the direction that it's going, and it just, people don't talk about it enough, so you feel like you have to kind of lean on tropes in order to just express that feeling, but oftentimes it's, like, not honest, and it makes you not like the person you sound like you're being, you know? I don't know. Me and Celine, I think we probably couldn't be friends because we're too much alike.
Yeah, there are a couple of things she said where I was like, ooh, that is painfully familiar. Like the whole, she says at one point, I'm going to get to the end of my life and I won't have done all the things I want to do. And then he presses her. He's like, well, what do you want to do? And she's like, very kind of like loosey-goosey, about, paint more, write more. Like, she's just like, it's clear. Like, she has this like abstract kind of idea of things that she should be doing, but like doesn't necessarily have like anything concrete. So it's like almost like it's always going to be the source of dissatisfaction for her.
Well, and it is in the third one that plays out, you know, she talks about like this sort of unrealized artistic potential or like, you know, realistically her romantic side doesn't get to live as loud as his does. And it's already like that in this one.
Yeah. So I will say, I thought like for some reason I didn't remember it from the first time I watched it, at least like it was kind of like a new experience for me this time, but like I totally forgot about the song that she sings for him somehow.
Oh man.
And it's a really good song. Like, am I crazy? Like,
no,
no,
I mean, it's been in my head for days, like since I listened to it last.
Oh, are you? I mean, realistic, straight up, like that song was not even written for the movie. She has an album. Like Julie Delpy has an album that released a couple years before the movie, and like that song is on there. And like,
I was wondering about that. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Listen, the levels of obsession. but yeah, like no, it was written before, and I think it does have the name Jesse in it even there. And who knows? Maybe she wrote. I've never actually read up on it, but like, possibly she wrote it about the movie as a sort of fan fiction thing of her own, you know, mind. But like, yeah, the song is good. I mean, the album's pretty good too, honestly, for what it is. You know, just a little singer songwriter thing. But the song is great, and it is this moment of like you wonder the whole time, like, you know, he's done this big gesture to find her, as he says, or even just to memorialize what they experienced together. And there is sort of this unspoken question of like, did she feel the same way? And the dialogue absolutely betrays that she does. But like to hear that is something that solidifies everything that's been happening, you know, in a way that like the film absolutely needs. It's like the perfect end button to like all this conversation that then, like, even after that, once they start listening to Nina Simone, it's even more relaxed than it was before. Like, if it's possible, you know, like, all of a sudden everything feels, they don't have to say anything anymore. You know, she does say, like, you're going to miss that plane, but she says it in a joking way. But, like, it's the final wall, you know, brick in a wall of, like, being broken down, basically. It's just, now they're ready to, like, have whatever happened, basically.
I could honestly talk for another hour just about that last scene in the apartment. Like, it's just so tremendously well done. Like, for instance, like, I watching it now for like a third or fourth time, like when they walk up to the apartment and they catch each other looking at each other, like that's the moment where they decide what's going to happen. Right?
That everything spinning else is fucking important. Camera angle up the staircase. Come on.
Yeah.
It's just incredible, and it's just, and that's your storybook ending. That's it, right there, the walk up the stairs, and everything else is just the foreplay after the words. And it's just, and I love the difference between the way that the two characters go about it, because they both they both met eyes. They know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
But she just won't let go of the pretense the entire time. And he refuses to engage with the pretense, basically. Like, yeah. He walks in, he immediately takes his jacket off. She's like, oh, do you want tea? And he's like, yeah, sure, whatever. Like, he doesn't care about the tea. He doesn't care about anything. Like, he knows what's going to happen. And she's like, she's making the tea. She's like, okay, only one song. Okay, fine. Even when she says, you're going to miss that plane, and I had forgotten about this, she's doing it as Nina Simone. So even then, she's not fully being vulnerable yet with him. That's how protective she is of this moment, because it's so intense, and she's such an intense person that she just can't let herself fully let go. And and in my mind, her letting go is the fade out. Like, that is, we're seeing him from her perspective after watching that most of that scene from his perspective. Mm-hmm. And that fade out is that finally releasing that tension and allowing herself to be fully vulnerable and to give in to this feeling that she's had from the second that she was staring at him at the bookstore in the very beginning of the movie.
Yeah, that moment when they first lock eyes, I like hadn't seen it. You know, I didn't think about it because there's so much other stuff going on. But like this time I was like, oh, my God, it's too much. The robot's too high. I can't handle this. I'm already going to die. Just
it was like one of those in like Jane the Virgin, they have these like moments where like the two characters will like lock eyes and then like flower petals fall from the sky and every, like that's what it felt like watching.
Right, and you get like voiceover, but like there wasn't, you don't even need the voiceover, it's all just, it's insane.
I guess
I read that moment when she is doing her Nina Simone impression. I guess I did read that more as her kind of easing into that reality at that point. Mm-hmm. Like, there's just something about the fact that it's an album that Jesse puts on after she's just, you know, sung her song, and the way she just kind of goes with it. I mean, I guess, yeah, she hasn't like completely dropped the pretense at that point, but I guess to me it's almost like an easing into that. Like, she goes like much further with it. Like, she's, even as she's like supposedly pushing him into that, it's still under the guise of this persona, this kind of comfort that she's found.
Yeah, I mean, I think you could read it both ways. Like, realistically, like, when she's singing the song beforehand and she cringes before she says Jesse, it's like she's still got that wall up. But when she says, when she says you're going to miss that plane, she doesn't say it in a way that she feels like she's warning him. It feels like she's flirting with him. Do you know what I mean? Like in a more open way than she possibly has the whole time. So like, I think you could read it either way.
Absolutely. Like that's absolutely true, but she is still flirting with him as Nina Simone. And she has previously just said about how like, oh, Nina Simone would always like flirt with the member of the audience, right? So she's like in character flirting in a way where it's like, yeah, obviously she's flirting with him, but she herself needs to hold on to that little pretense of just like, well, I'm just being Nina Simone. This isn't real, you know?
I think it's reading the way you read that scene is totally like, as like a litmus test of romantic or cynic or you know, analytic or neurotic or whatever, like as the ending is, like, honestly, I think both are totally valid, honestly, like, but I think that's the genius of the scene and the film is that like there are the thing that's so good about that ending is that there are infinite possibilities embedded within it, and like it's just a question of which one you can take, and like we get an answer to that eventually, and like I love that answer, but realistically they could have gone a million different ways with it and it would have been fine. We would have probably believed it because it's like the filmmaking and the writing is just so solid that like the potential is what is makes that scene so enjoyable, like, because he could have put it on, what if he'd chosen an album she hated you know, or hadn't listened to in years, you know what I mean, like, but there is something about choosing Nina Simone, and like, I mean, it also, like, I must say, like, when I was in high school at that point, I'd been really into Nina Simone for whatever reason. I feel like because it was on an episode, one of her songs was on an episode of a TV show I liked, probably Alias, frankly. But, like, And then I bought like an album, and then when I remember watching that for the first time, and I had already been a huge Nina Simone fan, and then that started playing, and I was like, "This is a perfect film." You know what I mean? Like, first time I thought, I was like, "This is a perfect film." How is not everybody not talking about this? This is a perfect film because it is like, what a choice for them to dance to, or like to sort of finally, you know, be in this space and intimate together, and like have no other excuses not to just say like, we're gonna do this, aren't we? Like, yeah. You're missing the plane.
It feels perfect. Like, there's no other way to talk about it. Like, it just feels like the perfect choice for that moment.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think like the way that you talk about that ending as just an ending of infinite possibilities, totally agree with. And I just think like, what a gift for the audience who like has been through this process of just like, the entire film is about this like existential dread of like your life settling into a place that you don't want. And you're just like kind of in cement that's just like slowly hardening, and like you're desperate to get out, and you're stuck. And then all of a sudden you get gifted this like world of possibility. That where anything could happen. And it's just, that's exactly what these characters need in that moment. And it's what the audience needs at the end of the experience.
Yeah. Well, I think it's so impressive that like, I really do feel like he somehow they recreate it every single time. I feel that way about, you know, my friend, you know, it sent my friend into a nervous breakdown, but like, I think there's so much, there are so many possibilities at the end of Before Midnight in a way that it doesn't leave me depressed or anything. Like, And I mean, like, you know, I kind of think, I remember at the end of this one, I thought like, no, they get together. And then like at the end of Four Minute, I still kind of think they probably break up, but I still think they're going to, but even if they do, there's a possibility they could get back together again, because like the pull is so strong, and like, maybe that's a way things could go. Maybe they stay together. Who knows? I'm just excited to hang out with them again, possibly in a couple years.
Yeah. I mean, the idea of like in my heart of hearts, like they get, like the next movie starts with like them having been broken up and having to be there for like his son's wedding or something. Yes. And like they're all at the table, and that's the whole, like, that would just be great. from like a story potential. But when I watched the movie, I thought like, it was not even a question. I thought for sure they were getting back together, like that they weren't breaking up at all.
Wow.
And I think it's like these movies just make me much more of a romantic than I think of myself as, because like at the end of each of these movies, I'm like, oh yeah, of course they get back together. Like, of course they meet each other in Vienna. Of course he stays and they have a life together. And it's like, of course they're staying together. There's no way they would break up. They're Jesse and Celine. How could they break up?
No, I mean, I was like, what she says it early on in the film, like, when I first saw it, I was like, yeah, they probably, when my friend had that question, he was like, what do you think they do? I was like, well, they probably, you know, have sex and then it ruins his marriage or whatever. And then, but then they probably don't stay together. Like, but that's the thing. I think that's what's so exciting about it is like, I as a storyteller and an enjoyer of story, I care more about the writing than I ever do about like, I care more about the execution more than I care about anything else. Honestly, I just am so excited to, like, hang out with those characters. And I'm not usually that person. I mean, I won't watch TV right now because I don't want to get invested. It feels like I'm in a relationship and I just, like, I can't do it. Like, I literally compare them to that. Like, if a book is a series, I literally won't touch it. But, like, this, I hope they make them until one of us dies. You know what I mean?
Well, 2022, I think, would be the next, I know, like, we're kind of over our time, but I did want to just ask the two of you, what do you think is a potential title for the next film?
I've struggled with this.
Alex, I'd love to hear your thoughts. It feels really boxed in, you know, like, there's just, there's not a lot of options out there. I mean, like, like, you would want to say, like, okay, well, it was Before Midnight, Before Sunset, then it was maybe it's Before Dawn, but, like, that's also sunrise. But that's sunrise, so that doesn't make any sense. You can't do that. Well, if you say you could go into After Midnight, but then it's like, but they're all before, so how do you go with after? So I don't.
And then you'd have to associate it with a quite mediocre Clapton song. That wouldn't be good for anybody.
And then you actually could go in reverse as they get older, because, like, realistically, you're marching towards death or something at that point, which is dumb. But, like, I wouldn't be upset with it. If you literally just went in reverse and went after midnight, after sunset, after sunrise, I mean, holy shit, I would be... I'd be fucking, you know, I'd love that. But, like,
it would be excellent. That is excellent, though. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
And, like, after midnight would totally fit into my pitch about it being at a wedding, you know, mm-hmm. where they finally get back together at the end of the wedding after midnight. That would work. So, right. Yeah. I'm basically saying, like, what if it's complicated, but starring Jesse and Celine? But, like, who wouldn't want to watch that movie?
Yeah.
I have faith. Anyway,
yeah, exactly. Like, that's the thing. It's like I have such implicit, you know, trust in them that, like, I almost don't even like to think about it too much, because I just want to be taken on the journey.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. All right. Well.
What a journey it's been.
Yeah. Oh. Any closing thoughts on Before Sunset?
No.
Maybe.
I feel like we've both said everything we could say about it, and also I feel like we could spend another 4 hours talking about this movie. So
yeah.
I guess my final thought is, like, if you haven't seen this movie, watch this movie. We didn't spoil it. It's an experiential film. There's no way that anyone could spoil it for you. Just watch it. It's fantastic. It's beautiful. It looks great. It's incredible acting and writing, and just, like, will make you feel alive. So do it.
Yeah. What Alex said.
Yeah. I just really quick, and this is not necessarily because this is more a rebuttal to myself than anyone else, but I think one of the things watching these, I've seen all these movies once, now I've seen this one twice. One of the things that I would say was something that I felt like maybe a little bit alone about was that I always felt more impressed with Julie Delpy than Ethan Hawke. But watching this movie again, I was really impressed with Hawke here. His reaction shots just always seemed so right and so true, and I know that because the way he was looking at Julie Delpy was exactly the way I was looking at her. So the things he would say were like, ooh, that's probably what I would have said, and not always in the most graceful or charming of moments. I think it just really spoke to, even though I do think, like, Julie Delpy has a lot, she might have more dialogue here, at least it seemed that way to me, but
she goes on and on.
Yeah, yeah. But he's just such a great presence, and the fact that, you know, a lot of these shots are the two of them means you do get to see some really great reactions, facial reactions to everything that's being said, and he has some really good ones. So I just wanted to maybe throw a little shade on my younger self and say that Hawke is actually quite good here.
I would second that. Even, like, I was really impressed with him this time. Like, I've always liked him in it, but, like, he makes really good choices in this that are, like, so smart, and, like, I don't know. It's weird that he didn't. It's weird that the whole movie doesn't get more Oscar attention than the writing nomination. And it's absurd to me that Sideways won over this for adapted. Oh, I mean, come on.
It's a travesty.
It's so rude. I mean, I'm sure I'll be talking about it on the Oscar pod whenever we do that year.
You don't want me on that, because I'll just be screaming.
poor Matt is going to be like, you know, it's only a nominated for one award. We can't talk about it for 2 hours.
Yeah, I think I would want to avoid any talk of Alexander Payne right now, quite frankly, but...
Oh boy.
Anyway.
What we know about the Academy Awards, and it's true now, but it was far truer in 2004, is that it's, like, predominantly, like, middle-aged white men, and I think that most of them probably didn't even sit down to watch a romance, you know?
Yeah.
And I think the ones that did probably, it was, like, too real, and they couldn't handle it, because... Yeah.
Well, I'm sure a lot of them fought with their wives, and then were like, I don't know, I don't really get it, you know, the screener or whatever, and they're like, it's fine, but nothing happens.
Exactly. They just talk!
Yeah, they're just talking. I mean, it looks nice or whatever, but, like, we've all seen Paris, you know, truly.
Yeah. So it's not much of a shock as far as I'm concerned.
No, not at all.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess we'll close it up there. I guess let's talk about where we can find everybody. So we're going to start with you, Marissa, our guest. Where is the best place to find you online?
I am at Marissa Carpico on every social media platform pretty much. Twitter, Instagram, you know, Letterboxd. You can find me writing at The Pop Break. I'm on a one movie a week sort of schedule right now. I don't know when this is coming out, so I can't say anything particular, but yeah, I'm sure I'm writing something.
Very cool. And, well,
I think by the time that this comes out, you should be in the middle of your new season of And the Winner Still Is.
Watch out for that. And the Winner Still Is, I'm sure we'll be doing something. We chose good movies this season because season two was like some of the worst years
I've ever had to watch. Oh no!
Like, every episode is brutal.
All right. Well, yeah. Look, I mean, I've enjoyed what I've heard from that podcast, so I look forward to seeing what the two of you have coming up next. Mm-hmm. As for me, you can find me on thecinemaverick.com. That is my website. I'm also on Letterboxd at thecinemaverick, where you can see what I've been watching recently. And let's go to you, Alex.
Yeah, so you can follow me on Twitter and Letterboxd at Media Thinkings. I'm also the editor for popbreak.com, so you can check out my stuff over there. That's thepopbreak.com. Also, Popbreak TV is a podcast which has a couple of my shows on it. Goodbye to All That, which focuses on season finales and series finales of TV shows that we're watching. And TV Break is a monthly podcast that I do with Josh and Bill over at Pop Break. And we just talk about the ins and outs of that month in television. And you can also follow our show at Cinema Joes on Twitter and subscribe to us on all of the various podcast platforms out there.
Awesome. Well, thank you, as always, for that. And we want to thank all of our listeners and our subscribers. Thank you so much for sticking with us. We hope that all of our listeners are staying safe during this pandemic. It's been a time, but we want to, like I said, hopefully this is a bit of a balm for all of our listeners, if nothing else. Let's close it out there. For the Cinema Joes, this is Justin signing off.